Hi there, I'm Gavin Crawford. I'm a writer, an actor, and a comedian. And for the last 8 or 9 years, I have been navigating life with my mother's increasing dementia. Has it been sad? Yeah. Has it been funny? Also, yeah. That's what my brand new podcast series, Let's Not Be Kidding, is about. It's the true story of my life as a comedian, my mom, and dementia. Let's Not Be Kidding, with me, Gavin Crawford. A new 7-part series from CBC Podcasts, available now.
This is a CBC podcast.
I'm Dr. Brian Goldman. This is White Coat Black Art. Opioids in rural towns go hand in glove. Back in 2017, the Canadian Institute for Health Information said the hospitalization rate from opioid poisonings in small communities is twice that of big cities. Now, there's something new and deadly. Earlier this year in Belleville, a small city in eastern Ontario, in just 2 days, 23 people nearly died from fentanyl poisoning. They're called accidental poisonings instead of overdoses because these days, street fentanyl is laced with non-opioid tranquilizers and other substances that can stop the heart. I've seen its effects in the ER. The people who live and work in small places wonder if their town will be next.
So we use a lot of Muskoka Brewery. We like to keep it local. So yeah, they're just bringing in some kegs for us as we're gearing up for the weekend.
Producer Jennifer Warren and I stand behind a restaurant that looks out over the Muskoka River.
A nice big skate rink back they put in this year. I think they got 1 day out of it, 2 days out of it, maybe.
A kid's playground to the left. In front of us, a flat area for summer picnics and concerts.
This is a good spot for a hangout.
This is Huntsville, a 2.5-hour drive north of Toronto. A place where almost everyone knows someone who's into fentanyl and in danger.
Hi, my name is Michelle Francis. I'm the general manager of the Mill on Main here in Huntsville.
Here's our kitchen. This would be our pass. This is like the server area, our expo line where we pull food down. One of our chefs baked us some treats this morning, so it's not on menu, but they're right there.
This is our main dining room area. You can see we have our bar set up here. We have our wood-fired pizzas right back here, so our guests can watch the pizzas being made. We get a lot of business from town with the theaters and things like that, so on theater nights we would be lined up at the door, very busy. And once summer hits, it gets a little crazy in here. You can be an hour to an hour and a half wait to get in sometimes. So, and that's from open to close, just busy, busy, busy. So I haven't actually opened it yet. I'm going to open it right now.
This is a big part of why we're here. Michelle Francis opens up a naloxone kit. She's putting this one opposite the wood-burning pizza oven right behind the bar with an easy reach. Just in case.
So it does have two nasal sprays in there.
She knows how to use it because she just finished taking the Ontario Workplace Naloxone Training Program. It's a 90-minute online session provided free of charge by the Ontario government beginning in December 2022. That particular program ended on March 31st. Michelle got to take one of the last courses offered at no cost. Beginning in June 2023, the province has required employers to keep a kit on hand if they know or suspect that a worker is at risk. The Mill on Main is not one of those high-risk businesses. They've never had an opioid poisoning on site. But they've decided it's safer to be proactive, to know how to recognize and manage an opioid poisoning until paramedics arrive. Whether that's enough to save lives is the question.
Yeah, this is where all the magic happens with the ambulances, equipment. But yeah, we went from a 2-bay garage at the old station we were in to this.
Hi, my name is Stuart McKinnon. I'm the deputy chief with the District of Muskoka Paramedic Services and Emergency Management.
For this part of the story, we take a 20-minute drive south to Bracebridge to meet up with Stuart McKinnon.
This station has our own fuel pump outside, so we have quite a large fuel system out there. We learned during the blackout of many, many years ago that we need to have backup fuel supplies.
The paramedics McKinnon supervises cover 4,000 square kilometers of sparsely populated central Ontario.
We had a call where, actually, Brad, the soup that you met in there, the paramedic, did an 8-hour response into Algonquin Park for somebody. Yeah. 8 hours on foot.
a paramedic here for 17 years, he's acutely aware that his people by themselves are not enough to save those with opioid poisonings. For a pure opioid overdose, naloxone is very effective, but less so when the street opioid is adulterated with sedatives and other substances. Which is why training for lay people emphasizes CPR and rescue breathing in addition to naloxone.
You know, I work in the emergency department in at a hospital in downtown Toronto, and there I'm seeing patients who are brought in who have taken some of these newer forms of fentanyl that are not just opioids. They're adulterated with other stuff. Have you seen that yet in this part of Ontario?
Yeah, we haven't seen any specific in Muskoka yet that we're aware of, anyway. But we have heard of some. We get reports from Toronto from their drug testing group, and they send notices up our way. So we make sure we keep our staff and the community informed about certain strains or certain additives that may end up in the supply in Muskoka. And more importantly, we make sure our medics know so that when they respond, they're not just focusing on trying to reverse the effects of an opioid that has been used, but considering other additives or things that might be in the substance and how they need to treat the patient to help them with those. And there's nobody that can say this won't happen in my backyard, the not in my backyard mentality. It is happening, and it's happening with, it could be teachers, lawyers, there could be doctors out there, paramedics. It doesn't matter who you are, what your upbringing was, or where you are today. It's impacting us.
Back at the mill on Main, the lunch rush is starting. The manager, Michelle Francis, takes us to a small private room upstairs.
Mostly it's used for the upstairs patio bathroom and our ice machine. A good place for us to wash our hands.
A lot of people listening to us would not immediately connect a restaurant with a place where you would want to train staff to know how to respond to an overdose. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, so there's actually a lot of drugs and things happening within restaurants. There really is. People think, okay, so I don't have drug addicts coming in here. We're more of an upscale place. And I think it's because society visualizes drug addicts as what you see on TV, what you see on streets, right? They're missing teeth, they're sketchy, they're whatever. But it's not. It's your soccer mom, it's your dad, it's your cook in the kitchen, it's your standard people, right? So, and we do. You get a lot of that coming in. We see it.
Nikki, a server here who we're about to meet, has also seen it up close.
Do you live far, far away from here?
No, I'm a 5-minute walk and I enjoy it.
And you walk?
Yes. I walk mostly everywhere. It's a good brain break for me to walk into work, walk home. Hi, my name is Nikki, and I'm here to talk about my beautiful sister Sadie's story.
You brought some photos.
I did, yeah. I did.
Who's the big sister?
She's the big sister. She's in the middle of three girls. Where's the house we grew up in? That's her swimming away in somewhere. Family dinner at mom's house, her and my baby sister. She's a huge basketball star. As a kid, as a matter of fact, at her celebration of life, she'd lived in this town. I'd lived away for many years. I was shocked at how much of this community showed up for her. And people come up to me and say, she always stopped. She always said hi. She'd always give hugs. She always remembered exactly who everybody was. She was a big, big part of this town. And a heck of a basketball player, heck of a sports player, actually. I often warmed many benches for her as a kid. We were very close in age, so we ended up on the same sports teams and whatnot.
Nikki's sister Sadie died in the summer of 2023 from an opioid poisoning here in Huntsville. Sadie was 38 years old. We're not sharing their last names because of Sadie's two young kids, currently ages 3 and 5. While they're underage, their dad wants to be the one who decides when they learn how and why their mom died. Nikki and Michelle took the opioid training program at the same time. Nikki's reason for taking it is deeply personal.
What were you hoping to accomplish by taking a naloxone course and all the other stuff that went with it?
I was hoping to gain confidence in ever facing that. I've had one in my home for quite a while, since I've been battling my sister and her addiction. And I guess I wanted to better equip myself because I know how quickly things can take a turn for the worse.
You said your sister was battling addiction.
Right.
Can you talk about that?
Of course. She's battled addiction on and off for most of her adult life. she'd turned a lot of things around, and she met the man of her dreams and had a beautiful family when she was closer to 40. Two kids back to back. It might have been a little too much for her too fast.
When did you first find out that she was using?
I mean, my niece is now 3, so it would have been within the first year of her being born. So we're going back a couple of years now for sure. I didn't really realize, or we, I guess, as a family, didn't realize how severe it had gotten until she got into an accident one day and had fallen asleep behind the wheel of a truck. And that's when I knew for sure that the opioid side of the addiction and the fun had gone out of it, and that it was that physical of a problem. That was about the time that my brother-in-law, her fiance, I should say, came back, and that was the last time she had her kids in the home with her that day, because there was a kid in the back of that truck, and she didn't mean for any of that to happen, of course. But that was a real eye-opener, as we didn't have a choice but to get those kids out of that home. And this is the time when they ended up with the father, which he had tried with her for a long time, and eventually he had to walk away for his own sake, and for, you know, and which put him in a great position to be there for those children.
Nikki shows me family photos down through the years. She and Sadie as kids growing up. A video of Sadie with kids of her own.
That's her voice. Being a super mom, she was. She really was.
Well, that was close.
This is Easter. She had a thing for matching the kids' clothes and everybody. She even made her husband wear a matching sweater that day. He was not very impressed, but he still played the part. There she is, matching again. Loved every holiday. Halloween, now as an aunt, I have to go all out. I never really was a Halloweener, but last year I Halloweened so hard for those kids, because in order to keep her memory alive, those are some things that I want to make sure that they know that she cared about. This is one of the last good days we had together. This is the second last time I ever saw her. Well, I was tapping her for a visit so she could see her babies.
After the kids were removed from Sadie's care, the heartbreak got worse for Nikki.
And then from that moment on, she was really challenging. A lot of blame. A lot of, The needle thing happened ridiculously fast. From the moment she told me that she had taken it to that level to the moment she passed, it was probably only a matter of 2 months.
Your sister had some incidents and I know you're calling them, colloquially we call them overdoses, but you're right, they're poisonings.
That's right. I did learn that through the course. I'm aware of a time where she'd had to use it on somebody else. And then I was aware that the same person used it on her the following day twice, because the first time it didn't work and the second time it did. That exact day was one of the days that she was to be taken to rehab, because many times has she asked for help and many times we showed up to help her. It's just tricky to time addiction with getting yourself into a bed and having everything in place to go. But I believe it was enough to scare her into going. I think it was one of the times she made it the longest, which I want to say was over maybe 10 days. It was one of the first times in about a year that I'd heard clarity in herself and her voice again, and really hoping that that was what it was going to be and that time it would stick. I believe it was 3 times in the last year that we were able to take her. And there were many multiple times where she'd asked and we had tried, and she had tried. I shouldn't say we had tried. She had tried to get herself there.
Nikki and her family don't have details about the night Sadie died of opioid poisoning. They know she was at her home. They've heard from people around her that for at least part of the night, she was not alone.
That always will bother me. I don't know if the kits that there were, because I know she'd keep them around. Like I said, she had to administer them before. I don't know if they had been used, if they had tried. I mean, you can only look into these things so much. First, you want answers and you want to blame and you want to, you know, take it out on somebody. But it's at the end of the day, I don't think it's really anybody's fault.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you.
Nikki found out the next morning that Sadie had died. She was walking to work at the restaurant when Sadie's fiancé pulled up beside her. He'd been driving around town looking for Nikki to tell her face to face. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Dr. Hillary McBride. Normally, therapy sessions are totally confidential, but in other people's problems, I open the doors to let you hear sessions with my long-standing clients. This is what people sound like when they talk with someone they trust about healing addiction, parenting stress, racist ideologies in the family, and other topics that feel so timely as we come through this difficult time. Other People's Problems, available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
You're listening to White Coat Blackheart. This week, what lay people at a restaurant in Ontario's cottage country are doing to prevent harm from opioid poisonings. Training, rescue breathing, and naloxone can mean the difference between life and death. For this to work, bystanders can't flee after calling 911. But here's the thing. In small rural communities, everybody knows everybody. And hanging around to do the rescue thing may seem too risky. Deputy Chief Paramedic Stuart McKinnon.
We give them out typically on a scene where somebody has either used their kit and now they don't have one on the scene, which would be high risk, or on a scene where somebody has used and they never had a naloxone kit to begin with. So we don't want to leave that scene knowing that there's a high risk of reoccurrence or potentially a strain of a substance that was so strong that the first dose of naloxone is not going to last and they're going to relapse into this overdose state or poison state. We want to make sure we leave them with a kit when we leave. I think the next step, though, is in addition to reducing stigma around these types of poisonings, is educating people more on what we can do to save lives. It's not just naloxone, it's rescue breathing, it's staying on the scene to be with the person, to be able to provide information to responders rather than leaving them alone.
So it sounds like you'd be in favor of pairing this kind of naloxone training with basic life support.
Absolutely. I think, you know, given the situation we're in, unless we can find a way to prevent these types of poisonings from happening altogether, we need to make naloxone training and other supportive measures part of first aid, CPR, and that type of training and education. We see it
but
kind
these
of
are familiar people. Like yeah. if you respond to them as a paramedic, you've probably seen them before, haven't you?
Yeah. We've had repeat users, repeat responses. And it happens in the community where it's really hard to force someone to go to the hospital when you're, especially if you use naloxone and they feel fine afterwards. Well, they're not going to feel great having naloxone after having a poisoning.
No, they're going to have cravings. They're going to be dope sick.
They're going to feel terrible and you're going to leave and potentially use again. And that's a real danger. And if there's nobody around that second time to call us back, there's a high risk there of death happening.
As a paramedic, you're kind of the last line of defense after the bystander. What do you think needs to change in a place like Muskoka and its approach to opioid addiction way before you guys are called?
Yeah, again, it's about stigma. We need to make sure people are not afraid to stay on scene. I know there's the Good Samaritan and Drug Overdose Act, which provides protections for most people that remain on scene. But I think we can go further just to make anybody who's on scene of a poisoning victim feel safe and comfortable to stay long enough for responders to arrive without worrying about having to hide anything that's been done prior to that moment. In that moment, the focus of everybody responding to that address or that site should be saving that life. And then we'll figure out the rest from there.
Canada's Good Samaritan Drug Overdose Act is designed to encourage bystanders not to flee the scene. It provides legal protection to folks who are using drugs or have drugs in their possession. It also protects them from liability for stepping in to try and help. The law has been around since 2017. But does having that law on the books make a difference when seconds count?
But I think any reasonable person in our communities, any reasonable person would expect you to stay on scene and help somebody who's been in a poisoning. I think it's, I'm here to help this person and I shouldn't worry about anything else. As long as I'm doing what's within my scope and what's expected of me to help this individual, I'll be fine.
I imagine that some people would leave the scene because the environment has drugs and drug paraphernalia and they're afraid of being identified as being in that place. And that's a natural fear. How do you get them to not be afraid of that?
Yeah, and that's a hard one in a small community where
responders are going to know who you are. I recognize people in the community all the time that I've responded to their family members or their homes, and I'm sure they recognize me and the other paramedics. And that's a challenge. And that, again, goes back to stigma. We need to not worry about that at that moment. We need to make it normalized that these things are in our communities. People are using these substances. People are experiencing poisonings. And at the end of the day, the goal needs to be to help, not to judge. And until we do, people will keep hiding. And I can think of, I've been on a couple calls, one specifically that I remember years ago when I was frontline on the road, where I responded to a 911 call. Somebody obviously made the phone call, but when we arrived, there was a young person on the front porch of this home who had been involved in a poisoning, and we had no other information, nothing to go by, but we knew somebody called 911. So there was a sad situation where somebody had left this individual potentially to die. You know, they tried their best by calling, but that was it. They ran, they fled the scene. And we'll never know if it was because of worrying about being recognized or if it was because they had other substances or drugs on them. We'll never know that. But it was a sad situation. And that one stuck with me. That was probably 10 years ago. And I still think about that regularly, especially as I drive by that area of the community.
And meanwhile, the situation's getting worse.
Yeah, you know, like I said, in Muskoka, we're not seeing the big spikes or the trends we're seeing in other areas. But if we look back at the data from 2018 to today, it's increasing. And I don't think any community can deny that. And I don't think any community can say they're immune to this. And there's nobody that can say this won't happen in my backyard, the not in my backyard mentality. It is happening.
It's happening. And Michelle Francis, the manager at the Mill on Main restaurant, is determined to do her bit. She took the course offered by the Ontario government. She says more is needed. So you've taken the training.
Yes.
How equipped do you feel now to handle a situation in which somebody's been poisoned?
Yeah. I do feel equipped. I do feel that it would flash back to me all of the things that I think I'm supposed to be doing from what I gathered from the training. I do think I would do okay. I would hope that I'm not the person that panics and goes, I don't know what to do. I would think that I would know how, but I honestly don't know.
What needs to change in the system to make you more confident, to make others more confident that they should intervene?
I think things like this need to happen more. I think that it needs to be out there more. I think people need to stop being quiet about our opiate crisis, and it needs to be out there. I think that more companies need to get involved. I think more training needs to happen. It should be available. This training course that I did, to my knowledge, this is the last where it would have been free to take, and then now you're going to pay for it. I don't want companies pay for stuff like that. It should just be something. If it's a crisis, it's real, it's happening, it's everywhere. We see it in the streets, we see it within workers, we see it within our families, we see it everywhere. So why is nobody taking it seriously, right?
Nikki has a very personal reason for taking the risk of opioid poisonings very seriously. She can't help but think of the circumstances of her sister's death.
I gather Sadie lived close to the hospital.
She lived at the bottom of the hill. But as close as you can get. She was born in that hospital. We all were.
And that's where she died.
And that's the home she died in. That's right, her. Yes.
A lot of people associate being close to a hospital with kind of safety.
Maybe. I could see that being a thing relevant to her, for sure. Thinking that if I really was that unwell, I could just walk up the hill. Or they'd be here in a minute.
And that's the point, that you know, part of the training is to try to get people to be comfortable to stick around,
right,
and not run away,
right,
when there's an overdose,
right. They should train this to young people coming up these days. You should be a preempt to a university career,
a life skill.
Thank you. That's what I was looking for. The more I've learned about it, the more I really wish everybody knew even a little bit about how to handle a situation like that, and that these would be good first steps for us to keep people alive. These people don't want to die. She just wanted to die. She wanted to get through it and get away from it. It's just such a powerful, scary thing when you lose control.
That's your pitch, and I hope people are listening.
Thanks. Appreciate that. Works for the platform.
This is so raw for you.
Yeah.
Why do you want to tell your story?
I feel like she would have wanted me to Because if I could just help one person or give somebody the strength to talk about somebody I love, I've been talking about her since the moment I lost her. It's one thing that has kept me going and keeps her relevant to me. And I'm sure it freaks a lot of people out when I discuss my late sister, but it's one of the things that has given me a lot of strength. So I think in doing this, I honor this strength that she's left me.
Downstairs at the restaurant, Michelle Francis zips up her newly acquired naloxone kit. She thinks she'd intervene if she finds someone in distress. But at least one of her employees has told her he's worried about being held liable for trying to help. Perhaps more needs to be done to make bystanders aware of protections offered by Good Samaritan laws. Michelle says she knows what she'll do next.
Make sure my health and safety team for sure has a look and reads the instructions, and maybe I'll get all staff to sign off on actually reading the instructions. I'm not making them use it. I'm not forcing any sort of thing, but maybe I'll make everybody read that just so we're not in the moment. Yeah.
Michelle is determined to do her bit to try and stave off the next opioid emergency, like the one that happened in Belleville, Ontario. I wanted to ask Deputy Chief Paramedic Stuart McKinnon how much he worries about a crisis like that. How concerned are you that something like that could happen here?
Yeah, something like that is scary, and it can happen anywhere. It can happen with any people. It can happen in any community. And I don't think there's any paramedic service out there that's prepared for that type of influx, especially, you know, small to medium-sized services like we have here in Muskoka. You just can't prepare for an influx of a substance like that and that many poisonings to happen at the same time.
Nikki can't bring her sister Sadie back. All she can do is hope others are inspired by her sister's story to try and prevent the next.
And that's my hope as a family, and maybe a community, to get real, talk about these things, talk about it, and we can get ahead of it, and maybe we can turn it around for people one day in our communities.
It's been really brave of you to tell your story.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you. I want to thank you for speaking to me.
Thank you.
A report published earlier this year in the Canadian Medical Association Journal found that illicit fentanyl is increasingly mixed with xylazine, a tranquilizer used to sedate horses and cattle. The authors say that while naloxone reverses opioid toxicity, it has no effect on the sedating properties of xylazine. That's our show this week. If you'd like to comment, our email address is whitecoat@cbc.ca. Whitecoat Black Art was produced this week by Jennifer Warren with help from Stephanie Dubois and Samir Chabra. Our digital writer is Jonathan Orr, and our digital producer is Ruby Buiza. Our senior producer is Colleen Ross. That's medicine from my side of the gurney. I'm Brian Goldman. See you next week.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.